This is the Humboldt Chronicles.
I am the queen of everything. Gotta be high before I can sway. Lighter TLNB. If you a viper.
I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. The Humboldt Chronicles is made possible by, and big thanks to, Archaeological Research and Supply, The Humboldt Cure, Eco Groovy Deals in Arcata, and this hour we welcome two new sponsors, Royal Gold and Papa and Barkley. Welcome aboard and thank you for your support. As of 16 days ago, recreational, medical, commercial marijuana, now legal in California. But oh wait, not everybody is on board with that. There's been some recent noise on that front, in fact, from the U.S. Department of Justice. Our focus this hour, then, is going to be, one, the rollout of California legalization, two, how do you do business in an industry that's legal here but illegal in the eyes of Washington, D.C., now that Attorney General Jeff Sessions has rescinded the Cole memo? And three, later, a look at the experience of a state that's way ahead of us in this cannabis business rollout thing. We're also going to be taking your calls a little bit later at 707-786-5946. You can also email us questions or comments at studio@humboldtchronicles.com. We're going to be talking with Congressman Jared Huffman this hour, also Mason Tvert in Denver, who was instrumental in Colorado's legalization effort. And here in studio with us, we're going to be talking with Ray Markland, General Manager of EcoCan in Eureka Brokerage and Dispensary, and Humboldt County Growers Alliance Secretary and Board Member Nate Whittington. First to Ray and Nate, first of all, thank you guys for being here with us in the studio. Let's go to January 1st, Legalization Day in California. Ray, to you first, opening day. I was driving around January 1st looking at some of the dispensaries I thought would be open. Some were, some weren't. Yours was, and I saw long lines. It seemed to be going well. What was your take on day one?
Yeah, it was definitely a pleasant surprise for us.
Good.
You know, it's Humboldt County. Our business model, obviously, we took into account that, well, we're going to try selling legal cannabis here in Humboldt.
Right.
You know, is that going to work? And there's a few dispensaries that have been around for a while doing a wonderful job already. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we thought, hey, you know, Eureka could use this. And so took about 2.5 years in licensing. And
2.5 years
yeah,
in licensing?
Yeah, we started the RFQ process with the city of Eureka was in 2015. One of the reasons things kind of got held up was Prop 64 was coming down the line, mm-hmm. which was going to change basically everything that had been written, or there was going to be a lot of pertinent changes to, you know, what we were going to have to comply with. Mm-hmm. So kind of a little moratorium in the middle of the application process there.
But you made it.
We did, yeah, and we're really, really happy to be there. Mm-hmm. The first was kind of a coming full cycle kind of thing to see, you know, our transition. We opened in September of 2017. So we had a few months of going just medical and seeing kind of what that industry was like. And then here we came up to the first, and we honestly didn't know what to expect. You know, we thought maybe a 20% increase in business and, you know, getting to see some people from Humboldt possibly that hadn't been into the legal cannabis scene.
You were hoping for 20% and you saw...
We saw a much, much greater increase than
good
that.
Good for you.
You know, and magnitude increase of a few hundred percent.
A few hundred percent?
Yeah, yeah. And so it was definitely surprising and very welcomed. And yeah, we're grateful to Humboldt County.
Well, with that kind of increase in demand, let me go to Nate. Were the growers able to supply dispensaries like that, given that kind of demand?
Well, I do know that we've had a great uptick in response from the county and cultivators in the county really willing to get involved in the regulated marketplace and spending a lot of time being extremely diligent in making sure they create a good business models and are bringing the good product to the table for patients and everyone alike. And I think what we've been seeing is a great increase in the ability of Humboldt County cultivators to go from this 215 medical model and turn that into a profitable business model. Now, obviously, the cost of compliance, regulation, and all the steps involved is completely new to a lot of us, and it's a learning curve. And But we are definitely seeing some of the results around the state, and we're extremely happy to have somebody like Ray here in our own backyard who is showing us a great example of retail and giving us a chance to showcase our legacy of extremely good product lines.
Well, Ray, let me talk about that permitting process then. Higher permitting costs. It seems that there are some restrictions from federal laws and regulations. It seems to me that starting a cannabis business is a little bit more difficult than starting a business of any other kind right now. First of all, is that true? And are these barriers to entry kind of a significant obstacle in getting into the legal cannabis industry? What's your take on that?
Yeah, you know, there's a few different fronts to that question. The first of which is, you know, political and community perception, opinions, and there's two sides to that. One of which is, oh, cannabis, we can't have this be a part of our community. And the other one is, legal cannabis is going to ruin our community. So there were two kind of...
So you're hearing both of those.
Yeah. Well, there are two fronts of opposition there, which we'll speak on, I'm sure, going into this. But talking about the difficulty of startup, this is a business that you can't hold a bank account. First and foremost, it's federally illegal still, so banks are held to that FDIC.
So what do you do? Is it all cash? And what do you do with employees about like just Social Security withholding? How do you handle that?
Yeah, so you can contract with management company or payroll services company to take care of some of those things. But
and there are some of those companies that will take on your business.
There are, frankly, they're skeptical. And so everything from insurance, you know, underwriters are very skeptical to write insurance policies.
What about banks?
Banks won't touch you. That's the main thing that none of this money can legally, you know, as far as the banks are concerned, can ever hit.
Right, because they're federally regulated.
They're federally regulated, right. And they won't touch you on you. They won't lend on your property. You're certainly not going to get a business loan. So the one thing about, you know, there's a entry-level bar for this business, especially building a retail storefront where either you need private investment, you need your own startup and capital, and then, you know, even the procurement, you know, and we were very lucky to work with a lot of local farms and producers, manufacturers and such that, you know, helped us with things, net 30 startup, different payment terms and such to just help us acquire the inventory we needed to be a functional business when we started back in September. And, a lot of waiting on all those things.
Well, Nate, let me ask you then, following on that, how do small farmers, where there may only be a couple of people, maybe only two or three people, how do they deal with all of this? Or are they?
Well, you know, I can speak from our farm, Ladybug Herbal Sanctuary, and we came into this knowing that starting small was going to be our key. So we applied for our county permit for 2,500 square feet. Mm-hmm. And it's just me, my fiance, and my sister who run this whole operation.
Three people.
We're organized as a mutual benefit corporation. And in this way, we're able to operate, create our product, do something that's manageable while we navigate this employee, state taxes, payroll, banking issues.
Insurance,
everything that goes along with
that. So you have to deal with some of the same things that Ray does as far as that goes.
Definitely. And, you know, the big thing that we've been doing in this regard is really getting organized with one another, other farmers and other people similarly situated. And, you know, we hold a lot of workshops out at my farm, and that's where we all just get together and talk about the troubles and the hurdles that we're going through and the steps we've been taking.
And kind of like an association where you swap ideas. And
definitely. And I think that's a big spot where the Humboldt County Growers Alliance has come in. It's created opportunities for this dialogue and for us to share these resources and information. And now we're kind of getting to the point where, you know, on my property, I have six binders so far for my permitting, my state licensing, and the organizational structure, the standard operating procedures. And I foresee us having probably 21 binders by the end of the summer once we get through it. But I think the real key here is taking all of this in small chunks, making it manageable, making it your own, and really putting your practices into it. One of the things I speak on often when I'm speaking to other cultivators who've, you know, let's be real, they've been told not to keep records, not to track anything.
Right.
And now we're getting to the point where we have to track every plant.
Just the opposite. Yeah.
The complete opposite. And it's really daunting. And, it's been discouraging to some people. But what I've been reminding them is, hey, you would not be a cultivator in Humboldt County right now unless you weren't good at something.
Right.
And if you're good at something, go home, write it down. Now you have the beginning of your process. And then it's just expanding on that.
Right.
And that's what we've been doing for 3 years. And now we're finally to the point where we can demonstrate that to others and help provide them a pathway to get involved.
Earlier this month, there was news, as you guys both know. Attorney General Jeff Sessions tore up the Cole memo. And for some of our listeners who don't follow this the way we do, the Cole memo was an Obama administration directive under which U.S. attorneys generally declined to prosecute cannabis businesses that were trying in good faith to comply with state and local laws and regulations in states that had legalized it. In rescinding the Cole memo, though, Sessions returned to those same U.S. attorneys the discretion to prosecute marijuana violations as each U.S. attorney sees fit. Co-producer Larry Trask asked our Congressman Jared Huffman earlier this week about that. Here's the Congressman's initial reaction.
Well, I'm disappointed. I'm angry. Like a lot of people, I'm confused, because while he has rescinded the Cole memo that at least provided some baseline of certainty for people, he hasn't replaced it with anything as far as I can tell. So we're just thrown into complete speculation as to what the federal enforcement priorities are going to be under this administration. But I think you can't ignore the fact that he's taking away the policy guidance that said as long as folks are playing by these rules, federal prosecutors will stand down. That has now been taken away, and I think you can't ignore the significance of that.
So, Ray and Nate, what do you do in times of uncertainty like these, Ray?
Yeah, I think a few things come into play. Kind of as Nate was saying, compliance is huge. Having your records organized, mm-hmm. knowing what you're doing, why you're doing it, do it with purpose. So, the big thing, there's this perception, even when we were in licensing, we were asked, how are you going to deter your cannabis from entering the black market? How will opening a retail outlet, what guarantees do you have that you won't be getting cannabis into the black market? Well, mm-hmm. for me, that's a pretty simple answer for us, and I think Nate will share this as well, and it'll kind of resound with a lot of people in Humboldt. You're not going to open a white market business to divert cannabis into the black market. Mm-hmm. So the big thing in this game right now is compliance. If you play by the rules and if they come, they're going to come. But the big thing is this, the people have kind of spoken and they're in support of cannabis.
They are 2-1.
Yeah.
In most states that have legalized. And in fact, nationwide, it's above 60% now.
Yeah,
but
finally.
Since Sessions rescinded the Cole memo, just out of curiosity, have you had any discussions with your attorney?
So for us, we haven't yet, because we kind of knew going into it what the risks were going to be associated with this, and the fact is,
given the current administration.
Right. Given the current administration and, even the current just general front for cannabis, it's high risk, mm-hmm. And it's something we're comfortable with, and the fact that, hey, this is something we believe in. I'd really hope that our... the attorneys and politicians will listen to the people, and the fact that it's generating positive tax revenue. It's a huge economic driver. Look at our county. I mean, what do we have left? This is our economy currently. And, this isn't a bad thing,
Nate, same question to you. Since Sessions rescinded the Cole memo.
Well, I would echo what Ray stated here. Here in Humboldt County, we already understand how to deal with the other side of the market. And those of us who are putting our necks out to do this correctly, we want to be transparent. We want to be able
Absolutely.
To have any regulators show up. And with that in mind, our farm really offered ourselves up to the Ag Department this last year to be a part of a pilot program for track and trace.
Right.
And,
explain what track and trace is just quickly.
So,
I know it's a big issue, but go ahead.
So track and trace is the system by which the California Department of Food and Ag and basically our local ag commissioner can track our products from planting, nursery stock, all the way up to harvest and where it goes into the marketplace. And, a lot of the big discussion has been around this whole idea of diverting our product into the black market. And that's really funny to me, because really what we're trying to do is show how we can operate in the white market, mm-hmm. and demonstrate that we have a pathway to do this correctly and that we are sophisticated farmers in that regard. And it was really a big bonus for us on a learning curve level as well, because by being a part of Humboldt County's SICPA pilot program, at the end of the year, I was able to print out spreadsheets that showed exactly what legitimate dispensaries took my product,
right,
which really helped me with taxation, helped me with accounting, and helped me with compliance with the BOE. So when this news came out about the DOJ and everything that's going on there, my mind was, you know what? We are doing such a good job of being above scrutiny. We invite more scrutiny, and we can prove that we're doing it right.
Well, speaking of that, let's get some advice for local marijuana-related businesses in California right now from Congressman Huffman. Let's hear what he has to say.
Well, I think they should continue to do what the good actors were doing before, which is scrupulously comply with state and local laws. Come out of the shadows, get yourself right with the law. Even with this uncertainty from the federal side, I think that's the right thing to do. The other thing I would say is that all of the folks who are trying to set this high standard of a legalized cannabis industry have even greater pressure, I would say, to really keep their noses clean. Because think about it. If you're Jeff Sessions and you hate marijuana and you hate all these states that are legalizing it in one form or another, the one clear angle that you have to do something is if there's interstate commerce, if there's trafficking, or if there's kids, or if there's one of these other kind of red line violations. And so I think he's going to be watching very carefully for that. I wouldn't be surprised if he's even surveilling or infiltrating legal operations, looking for some gotcha opportunities on trafficking.
Ray and Nate, he mentions he would not be surprised about infiltration and surveillance. Do you, two questions. Do you think about that? And two, do you hear anything about that in your industry in this area or statewide? Ray?
Yeah, it's always in our heads, which is why we train all of our employees on, you know, we actually just recently switched point of sale systems prior to the first, you know, so for our retail outlet that tracks in-house, it doesn't report anywhere externally, but just tracks all the purchases each customer makes just by their ID. So they register their ID and it tracks and alerts our bud tenders if anyone's approaching a maximum purchase, which is, you know, 28.5 grams of flower in a day or 8 grams of concentrate for the adult use market.
So you are keeping an eye on this just in case.
Yeah. Because a big concern for us, and, you know, it's kind of funny, we mentioned this, we did have two gentlemen come in who wanted to get in writing what I could sell them in the day. They tried to push for a larger sale. You know, they wanted to...
Who do you think they were?
Well, the don't want to make any assumptions, but when we offered to show them cannabis, they knew nothing about it. Didn't want to see or handle the product. We're just hoping that we could sell them some pounds
had
out
you
the back
them
door.
Before? No. Local people you knew?
No, they were some clean cut gentlemen who were very uninformed about cannabis, but were really really adamant that we should sell them some product out the back door, which.
Nate? after Congressman Huffman's comments there about infiltration and surveillance.
Right. You know, it's funny. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they aren't out to get you.
No,
right.
No.
You know, in our circles, obviously being small, I'm wanting to be able to scale up. And all of the different new players who are coming into the marketplace, we've had the opportunity to meet a lot of potential investors, potential partners, people who want to. I can't tell you how many times I've met with somebody who says, okay, I want a contract with you to buy your entire crop, and let's just iron that out right now. And you know, obviously being in this business long enough, you see the red flags of what people ask and what they know.
So you are aware. You're alert.
Intimately alert.
And this is not a surprise to hear Congressman Huffman say this.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think it's really happening as much of a level as he's alluding to. But
it's still good to be alert to it.
It's good to be aware and keep your head on a swivel.
If you are looking for something optimistic on this front, and we are, here's Congressman Huffman once again.
I think there may be a limit to how far even Sessions, who we know really despises marijuana and thinks it's like much worse than racism, and you know he's got some interesting and terrible perspectives on all this. There are limits on how far he can go with that because Donald Trump doesn't really care about this stuff. Donald Trump's base is actually against Jeff Sessions on this, and so it's very dysfunctional, but I think Sessions can only push it so far without probably losing his job.
You guys agree with that, Ray?
You know, one of the things, the unintended consequences of consequences, you know, that we see here is that this is bringing cannabis into the political limelight again. It's bringing it up kind of out of the shadows for a lot of people who have opinions about it. Mm-hmm. And guess what they're saying? They're saying we support cannabis. A lot of, you know, we talk about this being an issue of economics now. You know, we just recently saw the largest tax reform in recent history for our government. And what does cannabis do? Well, it makes a lot of tax money, right? So, you know, certainly as being the fastest growing industry in the United States right now and one of the largest grossing tax businesses, you know, this is a huge opportunity for the federal and state and local governments to make tax revenue to match up for, you know, the deficit we created there.
We are just getting started on this topic. After a break, we're going to compare our rollout of commercial cannabis to the Colorado experience. Colorado, as you may or may not know, is ahead of us in this. We're going to compare, contrast, and get some advice from the Rocky Mountain State. And a little bit later, we'll be including your calls and comments. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. Glad to have you along. And as we go to a break, a Cultivator Minute from Sarah Schutte and Joanna Berg of Dirty Business Soil Consulting and Analysis with advice on integrated pest management.
Integrated pest management is where you manage the health and vitality of your plants on all different levels, not just through fertilizer or pesticide application, but truly a holistic farm management strategy.
A lot of people just jump right to spraying pesticides when they see a pest, but IPM strategies include preventative monitoring before you get a pest so that you can treat it immediately, usually not using pesticides. And this way you can have a clean product at the end, and you use a lot of different management techniques, not just one. Most people just use the spraying technique, and we encourage people to use a lot of different types.
It is a very customized approach. Every farm is different. The climate of the farm, the production style of the farmer, the practices that work on one site may not be effective to the same degree on another site. And all factors are taken into consideration when designing your own IPM plan. So it's very customized. It's very site specific. The Cal Cannabis license requirements is to have an integrated pest management plan submitted as part of your cultivation plan. And I think a lot of farmers are perhaps not used to planning and writing down what they plan on doing. And the state is very specifically interested in knowing how you're going to handle a problem, especially when it has to do with an agricultural pest disease and the application of pesticides. So people are going to have to plan this out and submit it to the state and have it be approved by the state.
I'm Sarah Schutte, Dirty Business Soil.
My name is Joanna Berg, and I'm a soil scientist and co-owner of Dirty Business Soil Consulting and Analysis.
You can give us a call at 707-633-8885 or find us online at dbsanalytics.com.
Welcome back to the Humboldt Chronicles. We're going to be continuing our conversation here in studio with Ray Markland and Nate Whittington in a moment. First, though, a trip out to Colorado. It's a state where possession and home cultivation was approved back in 2012, and then legal sales followed in 2014. We're going to be hearing now from one of the folks who was leading the charge for legalization in Colorado. His name is Mason Tevert. He's now a vice president at VS Strategies in Denver, which is a government relations and communications firm specializing in the cannabis industry.
While there is a lot of experience with regulating products like alcohol, cannabis is a different product, and there is a bit of a learning curve. So we've just seen them slowly figuring these things out, but ultimately it's been going quite smoothly.
Is there still a black market in place in Colorado?
Colorado officials have estimated that anywhere from 70 to 80% of the demand in Colorado is being met by the regulated market, and the rest is being met by things like home cultivation. And the Marijuana Policy Group, which is an economic and market analysis firm, they said that they thought it would be upwards of 90%+ that's being met by the regulated market. So really, there's still some concerns about folks who are illegally growing or transporting cannabis to other states, but by and large, the demand among Coloradans is being met by the regulated market. We've got, you know, billions of dollars of cannabis sales that have taken place in licensed regulated businesses that would have otherwise taken place in the illegal market. Mm-hmm.
Has there been, or do you know of, any in-state movements to repeal Amendment 64?
In the very, very beginning, when the legislature was implementing Amendment 64, they had to pass a tax, basically because of our wacky tax laws in Colorado. Amendment 64 required the legislature to enact a tax that would then need to be approved by voters in accordance with our Taxpayer Bill of Rights. And there was a proposal to include a provision in that that would have repealed Amendment 64 if the tax had not passed. That proposal ended up failing and was not included, and regardless, voters overwhelmingly approved the tax anyway. But since then, there really hasn't been any discussion. We've seen polling consistently show that support is just as strong or stronger than it was when Amendment 64 passed. In fact, a poll from Public Policy Polling in the fall of 2016 found that only about one-third of voters would support repealing Amendment 64. And so clearly that's just not much appetite for that. People seem to think it's going as it should, and perhaps there could be room for improving regulations over time, but no one seems to be interested in going back to the prohibition type model.
I read a comment from you, I believe it was in the Denver Post, if I'm not mistaken, where you said that Colorado's tax revenue in this case is just the tip of the iceberg as far as benefits go. Tell me a little bit about that.
Obviously there are a lot of economic benefits when it comes to transitioning from a prohibition model to a regulation model. The state is generating, in Colorado's case, the state has raised more than $500 million in revenue, and then localities have raised millions of dollars in addition to that. Of course, there's all the jobs being created and all the business that's being generated for other types of industries, whether it's accounting or legal or construction or what have you. So we know that there's all those benefits, but really that is just a bonus. The biggest benefit is that the thousands and thousands of Colorado adults who choose these cannabis are now able to purchase it safely in a store where they are paying taxes, where they know what the product is, they know it's not contaminated, it's been tested, it's labeled, they are not going to be potentially subject to violence or other crimes, they're not going to be exposed to other illegal substances or products. That's the true benefit of ending prohibition. And the fact that we also get to generate some revenue from this now the illegal product, that's really just a bonus.
I think that's a really smart way to look at it from a broad public policy standpoint. Anytime you're talking about millions of people in any state, it's good to take a look at it under that broad public policy umbrella to kind of get a good perspective from 360 degrees. Who's benefiting? Who's going to be harmed by this? What are we going to look at going forward? I like the way you look at that. Is that kind of the big lesson that you tell other states who come to you with questions as they move into this?
Yeah, generally, this shouldn't be looked at as solely a economic driver. Now, I will say that in a state like California, and especially in Northern California, this is a major economic issue, and that is something that is serious and does need to be taken into account, that, cannabis production and sales have been a big part of certain local economies for a very long time. And so I don't want to downplay the important role that the it plays in that. But big picture, when it comes to whether or not these policies should be put into place, we really need to be, prioritizing public health and safety and then the economic benefits after that.
Back in the studio here with Ray Markland and Nate Whittington. Nate, to you, he was mentioning safety there, labeling, knowing that what you're buying, what you're ingesting is not contaminated. That's a big part of what you do at your end in the cultivation.
Yeah, definitely. On our small farm, we're always striving to do better sustainable practices. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to meet a lot of the great mom-and-pop family growers here in the county that go back, considerable ways, multi-generational. And they've developed some amazing techniques to really be good stewards of the land and the property. And it's funny that now we're getting into this newly regulated marketplace where those hallmarks of their family product is really what everybody should be striving to, and everyone's trying to learn how to do. So when you think about the big difference between Humboldt County and the rest of the state, you got to think about the fact that part of our quality has been around the sustainability and the ability to, use beneficial plants and other techniques on these small family farms because they also grow their food there.
Yeah.
And that's
so
really going to be
obviously incentive there.
There's obviously
right.
an incentive yeah. and an earmark there. And I think that's going to be one of the driving forces in the economic viability of our product lines.
Ray, to you, as Mason was saying there, initially, there were some attempts to repeal in Colorado. Do you hear anything about that here in California so far?
No, not so far. You know, we obviously just had the backlash from the feds, which seemed a direct response, basically, to California's legalization, yeah, you know, a few days
but
after.
But within the state? That.
No, I haven't had that brought up to me at all.
Let's talk about the black market. As Mason mentioned, there was a black market that persisted right after legalization there. It has continued to diminish. Nate, what do you hear about the black market here? And are you concerned that a persistent black market could have an impact on the viability of the legal market or not?
Well, I think these are two very different worlds. You know, the people in the black market, they know that they're on a limited time span, and obviously the county of Humboldt has been very proactive in trying to incentivize those of us who are doing this legitimately by giving us a chance to get interim permitting and get a chance and to get access to temporary licensing. And at the same time, they're also we're starting to see more scrutiny on these other properties and other actors, and I think that's definitely having a wave effect. And so the writing's on the wall. It's time to get in, do it right, and move forward correctly, and hopefully that's going to help sustain the economy of this area.
I think we have time to go back to Mason in Denver for one more comment here. His take on doing business in times of conflicting state and federal law, and also, interestingly, getting otherwise conservative politicians on board with this.
A lot of the states can get this going on their own, as we have seen and continue to see. Just imagine how much easier it would be with things like banking for businesses just trying to do federal withholding and payroll, and then also interstate commerce, being able to ship a case of your product to somebody in Boise or wherever, Wichita.
Well, absolutely. I think that as more and more states pass these laws, we'll see support continue to grow at the federal level, which is what we saw in the last handful of years. You know, there were members of Congress in Colorado, for example, who really never got very involved on this issue. And following the passage of Amendment 64 in 2012, they became far more engaged, some of them very outspoken. And that's what we're going to see in these other states as these laws pass. As this industry grows and plays the same type of role in the economy and in the state as other legal industries, and they create jobs and they create revenue, they will get more attention from their elected officials, and elected officials are going to learn about these issues, and they're going to be more inspired to take them on, and we'll just continue to see this become a bigger priority for more members of Congress over the next few years. And hopefully that will culminate in the passage of some policy changes.
Ray, there's an old saying in politics that it's the people who lead the politicians and not the other way around. Is that kind of how you look down the road? Eventually, politicians will see that this is working, that it's good for the state, and they will come on board. And that's going to be rolling out nationwide, and eventually there will be federal changes or not?
Yeah, I think at this point it's a tide that's going to be very hard to turn back.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing... You know, we're seeing Arkansas has medical cannabis now. Boy, if that's not a sign of the times changing. You know, had you said that 5 years ago, even people would have looked at you like
nobody would have
crazy.
Believed
it. Yeah. So I think at this point, the people have spoken and will continue to speak, you know, and it's a matter of, you know, you can't deny something that everyone, you know, is in support of forever.
Right.
You know, and my thought on it is, you know, everyone, large business as well, is getting their feet wet, whether it's the alcohol industry acquiring cannabis companies in Canada, you know, and it happened with Heineken, you know, over $1 billion acquisition. But same thing, you know, we're going to see large agro companies. We're going to see, you know, pharmaceutical companies exploiting the medical benefits of it.
Research,
yeah. R&D. Yeah. And so as everybody starts to kind of get into it, at that point, you know, money talks as well. And that's something that you know, we see here already in California, you know, the licensing cap, you know, things like that, you know, where big business is here, you know, and it's going to continue to grow.
Our guests are going to be staying with us, and we're going to continue to take a look down the road with them. Plus, next, we're going to add your calls and emails to the discussion. You can reach us at 707-786-5946 or email us at studio@humboldtchronicles.com. Before a break, though, a cannabis calendar minute. If you're in the cannabis industry or just interested in it, here are a few events going on soon that you might be interested in.
Welcome to this month's edition of the Cannabis Calendar, brought to you by the Humboldt Chronicles. The calendar features information on upcoming cannabis-related conferences and events that take place within a day's drive of Humboldt County. Dirty Business Soil Consulting and Analysis will be conducting an overview workshop focusing on integrated pest management at their lab on 11th Street in Arcata from 1 to 3 p.m. on Saturday, January 20th. More information is available at dbsanalytics.com. Also on Saturday the 20th, Green Bicycles is presenting the California-Oregon Cannabis Exposition from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. in Crescent City at the Del Norte County Fairgrounds. Visit CalOrCannaExpo to learn more. Finally, Humboldt County Processing Company, Dark Staffing Solutions, the Humboldt County Growers Alliance, and Northern California Safety Consortium will present a free workshop on a variety of safety and health topics related to cultivation and processing of cannabis. Topics to be discussed include worker rights, employer responsibilities, and how to provide a safe workplace. The workshop will take place Friday, January 26th at the Inn at 2nd and C in Eureka from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. More information is available at hcga.co. If you'd like to have your event listed on the cannabis calendar, email us the details at studio@humboldtchronicles.com.
I'm Chuck Rogers. While I have a second that music there, for folks who have not listened to this show before, that's Aaron McEwen. The name of that song is If You a Viper, written by Stuff Smith way back in 1936, made popular by the one and only Fats Waller. Now you know. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. Here in the studio with us are Ray Markland of EcoCan in Eureka and HCGA board member and secretary Nate Whittington. And we want to bring you into the discussion now. You can call us at 707-786-5946 or shoot us an email at studio@humboldtchronicles.com. Nate and Ray, during that break, we were talking about a very interesting topic that I'd like to get to here while we have a few minutes. You guys were telling me that California is the only state so far, among the states that have legalized, the only state so far where cannabis is seen as an agricultural product. Why is that an advantage for us?
On a cultivation side, this has been a great advantage for my farm and for other people that I work with. Not only has it helped us to create better allies with the ag department and county government, it's also given us access to resources we've never had before.
Such as?
Well, I was speaking with the ag commissioner, and we were talking about pest management. And we were talking about what kind of pesticides we can use and identifying problems. And, Commissioner Dolph, he reached his arms out wide, and he said, Nate, let me tell you something. California has defined cannabis as an agricultural commodity. You are now within my arms, and I'm here to help you. And with that said, he's given us access to state-level testing, state-level results, the state database, and he's also helping us to push on the research edge, because now that we have defined this as agricultural in nature, now all of the benefits that go along with California agriculture, because we know California ag is, one of the largest in the world.
Huge, yeah.
And it's really that earmark that sets us apart from every other state in the union. And I think this gives us an opportunity to set our cannabis marketplace apart as well.
Ray, how is it viewed in other states? If not agricultural, how do they look at it?
Yeah, so we get back to this whole issue of cannabis being this highly dangerous,
Demon weed, highly regulated, the
devil's bush. And so when it's not categorized as an agricultural commodity, it's much stricter regulated in a lot of ways. And that goes down to, we're fine with the track and trace and all that. But what becomes a problem is when you have cannabis as a Schedule I drug that's potentially poisonous to animals, humans, everything there.
Right.
So they do treat it, a common is made, treating it like nuclear waste or plutonium or something like, and in a lot of ways.
Seriously.
You think about how it's transported, how it's tracked and traced from the seed to the consumer.
Gotcha.
There's really, really very rare and few parallels to how cannabis is treated, and certainly none that I'm aware of in the agricultural realm. You know, you think about even tobacco, or even, you know, we jump a little farther away from ag into alcohol. And, you know, you think about, you know, we're starting to see some of the parallels in California to that. But the advantages of being an agricultural commodity and recognized as such in the state of California is huge for a lot of the research and development that's needed to go into farm management, sustainability, you know, the viability of certain pesticides, and, you know, basically the future of this as a recognized commodity as opposed to, you know, a hazardous product.
So earlier we were talking about learning from the experience of states like Colorado and Washington, other states that are ahead of us. Would this bring up an advantage to California not having gone first, so that we knew, let's get this organized agriculturally as opposed to some other way, so we benefit now? Is that is that fair to say? Because in Washington, right, you were saying that it's not viewed this way, right?
Well, you know, in Washington, it's run by the Liquor Control Board. And I have family up in Washington, and my partner and I, we started looking into Washington when I-502 came out. And when we started looking through what it was going to take to be licensed and legitimate up there, we saw a lot of limits to our ability to do research, be diverse, and be innovative. You know, one case in point is once you get your state license, you have a 15-day window to get all of your genetics in.
And 15 days.
They don't ask where. You get all your genetics on your place, and then you can only trade genetics with other licensed producers. Well, necessarily, you've just limited the gene pool for the entire state's commodity and product line. Whereas here in California, we can innovate new genetics, new techniques, better nursery, better, you know, cloning techniques, seed propagation. And that creates a diverse, robust fauna for this. So we have a chance to really drive innovation and research. And on the flip side, you know, when you think about notions of how do I protect my farm and the way that I've grown in this area, that's having the ag commissioner, like here in Humboldt County, we have this cottage artisanal category, and that's what our farm is. We're less than 3,000 square feet. We live on site. We use organic practices. And now we're going to be able to get the track and trace artisanal stamp, which really goes to our county of origin and really drives us forward into this definition of appellations that are not defined by some corporate entity, but actually by the players on the ground who are experiencing this in an agricultural world.
Ray, on the retail side, is that an advantage? Would you know that something is coming from Nate like that?
Absolutely. It's a huge advantage to us as a retailer, but mainly, you know, this comes down to your consumer. You know, you talk about you don't go to Sonoma to drink Italian wine, right? So hopefully, you know, when you're here in Humboldt County, you know, if you're visiting or you're local or whatever, in my opinion, and this is pretty widely shared, I think we have the best cannabis in the world here, along with the best cultivators. And, you know, that goes for both outdoor, mixed light, and indoor.
Well, speaking of which, before we went on the air, you were relating to me a story about reporters from various newspapers and media outlets in Los Angeles and the Bay Area and Sacramento, I believe, coming up here because Humboldt is Humboldt.
Yeah.
The Napa of, we sometimes hear. You found that to be true. That is the notion, as far as you have heard so far, outside of Humboldt, given the fact that these reporters are coming here.
Right? Yeah. No, we saw quite a few different reporting agencies in the week leading up to and the day of January 1st coming up here to see what's happening in Humboldt. You know, we're talking large publications and firms, you know, coming to see. So this is the heart of cannabis production, you know, and then they had an interest in, well, what's going on here? You know, is Humboldt County excited about legalization? Is there, you know, a concern about legalization? So there are a lot of questions about that. And, you know, what does Humboldt County want to see from legalization?
Tell me about day one when those reporters were at your at your place of business on January 1st, what they assumed they were going to see and what they actually learned.
So I think they assumed that we might be similar to Berkeley, which had people camping out the night beforehand, outside retail locations, and people selling food and, carnival aspect. Well, what we had, we were opening at noon on the 1st, and come 11:30, this gentleman's there from San Francisco Chronicle, and he's there reporting, and there's one person in line. And, he's looking at me like, oh, man, you got to be worried about this. Why is there only one person in line here on the 1st? And, like I told him, well, we kind of planned for this. This is Humboldt County. There's a lot of cannabis around. And, hey, maybe the people who want rec cannabis already have it. And, I said, well, wait a little bit later in the day. See what happens after word of mouth goes around.
Did you instruct him about Humboldt time?
I let him know, this is, you're not going to have a line of people around the block at 11:30. But I told him, and this was even in the article,
it's a late arriving crowd, but the crowd will be there.
I told him, come back at 12:15 and see.
Or 12:30.
And
especially 4:20.
Yeah.
There you go.
And it actually rang true. We had a huge outpouring of community members coming to see what recreational cannabis was about come 12:15 to 12:30. And there was a line at opening, but it grew in mass throughout the day. So it was exciting.
Well, congratulations to you both on how well it's going so far. We want to thank our guests, Ray Markland and Nate Whittington, here in the studio. Also, Congressman Jared Huffman and Mason Tvert at VS Strategies in Denver. Larry, did you learn anything this hour?
Well, two things, actually. I was really intrigued by Ray's story about the guys coming in, short hair and suits, saying, "Hey, could we get a couple of pounds out the back door?" So that was on day one too.
Sounds like a movie, doesn't it?
It was really a really odd thing. And the other thing, which I realize now, we didn't have time to get to, but when I talked to Congressman Huffman earlier in the week, I asked him about the prospects of legalization at the federal level,
right?
And he told me that he believes that the votes are there, that there's bipartisan support for it, and it would happen if the leadership would just bring the bill to a vote. And so I was interested to hear that he thought if they voted on it, it would pass.
And if Congress had the capacity to agree on anything.
Exactly.
So, we will keep an eye on that. I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. This edition of the Humboldt Chronicles will be posted soon at 941lounge.com, at lostcoastoutpost.com, and at iTunes for listening and downloading. Once again, thanks to our sponsors, Archaeological Research and Supply, The Humboldt Cure, Eco Groovy Deals in Arcata, and our newest sponsors, Royal Gold and Papa and Barclay. Thank you very much. And we will be back with the next edition of the Humboldt Chronicles at 6 p.m. on Wednesday, February the 21st. We'll see you then.